Hello and welcome to day 3 of Crikey's Election Cast, a podcast that will give you an independent and honest look at the politics, policy, and campaign antics in the lead up to the federal election. My name is Cam Wilson, and it's Wednesday, the 13th of April. Now that we've got a little bit acquainted, I hope it's not too forward of me to ask just a tiny favour. If you have a moment, would you mind giving us a review on whatever podcast platform you use? It really helps us out and helps other people find our podcast. Okay, now onto the good stuff. Today, our Tips and Murmurs editor Charlie Lewis is speaking to Crikey's politics editor Bernard Keane about the election stories the media is talking about too much, the stories they're not talking about enough, and whether it's okay to go and get a beer with the Prime Minister. Just one small thing, we do record the Crikey Election Cast live every day, and unfortunately today's episode has a bit of an audio glitch. You can still understand it perfectly, but the audio quality isn't quite where we'd like it to be, and we'll make sure we'll get it right next time. Over to you, Charlie.
So let's get straight into it. Thank you again for joining us. So on Monday, Anthony Albanese failed to name the unemployment rate and the cash rate, and the coverage on that is now in its third day. But you wrote a really interesting article yesterday, and then you followed up today, about possibly a much bigger story that's not getting anywhere near as much attention. Tell our readers a bit about that.
Well, let's just on the Albanese gaffe, I wrote a piece on yesterday about how this was actually a serious thing, but it's the extent to which it's dominated coverage is quite ludicrous and is gone quite beyond all recognition. But that's particularly problematic when there are other really interesting election stories going on. And the big one for me at the moment is Barnaby Joyce yesterday announcing $1.5 billion worth of infrastructure funding for a wharf at the charmingly named Middle Arm in Darwin for new port facilities, which are primarily going to benefit our friends in the fossil fuel industries, and particularly the burgeoning liquid natural gas, or should I say liquid liquefied gas industry in the Northern Territory. So that's $1.5 billion of our money that's is being committed to this. This is a project, by the way, that's not being scoped out. There certainly hasn't been any cost benefit analysis. But the government has put its hand up and said, we're going to give this to the fossil fuel industry. And by the way, Labor, it only took Labor a couple of hours to back the project as well. So taxpayers, $1.5 billion for fossil fuels, you're very welcome. And if you're wondering why Labor would have rushed so quickly to endorse this project, despite the extreme cost, it's because it's in the marginal seat of Solomon in the Northern Territory, which is held by Labor's Luke Gosling on a margin of 3%. So that's our political state at the moment. Bipartisan pork barrelling. I guess you can have pork barrelling if it's bipartisan. But no cost benefit analysis and no restraint when it comes to looking after the big fossil fuel companies that provide so much in the way of donations to our political parties.
That's a really interesting point. I remember, yes, there's a very, very memorable and vivid line from your piece today saying bipartisan pork barrelling still qualifies as pork barrelling. I suppose there's a lot of things that come out of that story, but is there a bit of a sign that Labor, as you say, they've leapt in behind this very quickly, that they've abandoned the climate as a serious policy as much as the Liberals have, but maybe not as much, but to a similar degree?
Well, neither side of the major parties really wants climate to be an election issue. Scott Morrison is hoping, and probably quite rightly, that the press gallery is not going to press him on the fact that he has zero in the way of climate policy, literally in the case of net zero by 2050, which is a meaningless and distraction of a policy. But Labor is not very keen to make climate a point of difference itself, because it fears that it will become a source of division between urban voters who want stronger climate action and a relatively small number of voters in regional marginal seats who might react against more ambitious climate policy. So we've got bipartisanship on the fact that climate is not really going to be a prominent issue in this election, when of course it should be front and centre as the key policy that we are discussing, and Australia's complete lack of ambition or even complete lack of action in that regard.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's very easy to forget. We are a few weeks away from a catastrophic sounding report from the IPCC. So for that not to register really much as much of an election issue is a real sort of, I guess, slight on the press gallery. And I guess moving on to the press gallery, there was a lot of eyebrow raising about the story that came out this morning about Scott Morrison's drinks with a group of journalists. Not so much because of the gatecrasher, because it seems as though at the moment Morrison kind of has to just deal with that as part of his day-to-day life, but more that the drinks were kind of happening at all. A lot of people have been talking about this as though it's somehow uniquely indicative of a kind of corrupt level of closeness between Morrison and the press gallery. But is that actually the case? Is this something that actually just happens across the parties?
Well, yes, it is. Every year, if you're in the press gallery, you get invited to Christmas drinks with the Prime Minister and with the Leader of the Opposition. So you go to the lodge, you have drinks with whoever happens to be the Prime Minister, in a spirit of Christmas cheer and seasonal goodwill, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, the same thing happens with the opposition. It's well known for leaders to mingle, socialise with the journalists who are, quote-unquote, on the bus, i.e. in the leader's sort of campaign entourage, although that tradition is thankfully slowly starting to erode because media companies who pay a very large amount of money to put a journalist on those buses and planes have started to work out that really it's not worth pretty much a single cent. So the idea of politicians and journalists mingling is, you know, pretty standard. And if people have got a problem with it, and I'm on Twitter, I see a lot of people having a problem with it, I think they're missing the point that both sides do it and good journalists are not affected by it. The problem, of course, is poor journalists can be suborned and pushed in one direction and glad-handed and respond to favourable treatment. But the, you know, the give and take between politicians and the media, you know, is much more. It's about transactions and it's about access. It's not about who you have a drink with. It's politicians giving stories to favoured media outlets, giving stories to journalists they know are going to treat it, you know, in a particular way. It's not about who you had a beer with, because both parties are seeking to get something from this relationship. Journalists want a story. Politicians want favourable coverage, and it's that access. It's that that transaction-based relationship that is much more of a problem than journalists having a beer with the Prime Minister or the Leader of the Opposition. It's that, you know, the issue is not physical proximity. You know, you can have a deeply problematic stenographer-like relationship with ministers, even if you live 2,000 kilometres away from them. I mean, it doesn't matter. Ultimately, it's not about having a drink.
Yes, which does, I suppose, raise the question, and I don't know if you've had any specific thoughts about this. Is there a way, what is the way around that for say, a young journalist starting out? Is there any way to kind of be an effective political gallery reporter without having to kind of make these sorts of compromises?
Well, compromise is the issue because for a lot of journalists, access journalism is how they work. They get stories and they are encouraged by their editor to get stories by forging relationships with politicians on both sides. And in effect, having that sort of transaction-based relationship. And if you're not prepared to do that, then you do kind of get frozen out. If you, and you know, Crikey has endured this for many years, if you are outside that system, then you don't get access to stories or you get very little access. People don't turn to you, you know, to give you information that they hope you'll use in a certain way. So you've got to either fully commit to using all the resources that are at your disposal as a journalist to break stories that the powerful, you know, people in positions of influence don't want broken, or you can engage in access journalism. You know, the best journalists do both, of course. The best journalists can have access to and engage in transactions with senior political figures, but they can also do proper, real investigatory journalism. And do it well. So it's not an either or, but certainly if you're not prepared to engage in transactional journalism, then you've really got to be prepared to do a lot of digging and a lot of hard work.
following on from that, we've talked a little bit about, I suppose, that sort of going from the press gallery and the insiderism to kind of more of the outsiders. There's been a lot of coverage recently about the kind of flurry of independent candidates who have been particularly sort of campaigning around climate and integrity, and particularly targeting the kind of more quote-unquote moderate members of the Liberal Party seats. Not all of that coverage has been particularly flattering, though. What have you kind of made of that?
Well, there's been a lot of it's politically motivated. News Corp has gone hard after a lot of independents who they sense rightly are a significant threat to coalition candidates. So there's been quite a bit of demonisation of independents, tenuous, you know, attempts to link, forge into a more concrete form, tenuous links between independents and some supporters. And, of course, the picking up of the line that the coalition's been running, which is that these independents are somehow just, in effect, Labor candidates under another guise. It's like, you know, it's like the, you know, when the monster's caught in Scooby-Doo and they pull the mask off and it's, you know, old man Withers from who runs the carnival. You know, the coalition argument is, you know, unmask these people, it's just another Labor candidate. Well, I've also found the kind of the gender aspects of the coverage quite fascinating. Alexander Downer, who you can pretty premise everything that Alexander Downer by saying, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? His observation this week that what really these female independents really are doing is just being in the way of putative great men like Josh Frydenberg and Dave Sharma, with the suggestion that they should just get out of the way and let men get on with governing, was, you know, a much more blatant example of that. But I was fascinated. I'm just fascinated by the fact that there are constant attempts to paint independents as all linked together into a monolithic movement, that they're all part of some proto-party, and that Simon Holmes a Court is really the puppet master behind behind all these independents. So you've got this quite disparate movement, very, very different candidates, very, very different movements across different seats. The seats themselves are very, very different. In some cases, the voices of campaigns within particular seats, they don't even endorse the high-profile independent that's standing. In other cases, they do. You know, i.e., the picture is complicated, and the picture is of a grassroots movement, not an organised top-down political party. But it seems a political journalist can only see this through the lens of political parties and see it through the lens of personalities. Thus, you get this extraordinary range of in real life, outside politics, very accomplished female candidates who are being reduced to sort of cat's paws of Simon Holmes a Court and his Climate 200 movement on the basis that they've received support from him, when in fact the impetus for these campaigns has come from within the community. And this, you know, this urge to kind of to shrink and diminish a genuine community-based set of movements. It's not one movement, it's a set of movements, into this kind of this filter of, well, this is just another political party, I think, you know, reflects a the way that the press gallery really does just see everything through the lens of political parties. And why not? I mean, that lens is usually pretty effective for reporting on things in Canberra. But B really fails to understand what's actually going on in these particular electorates. And you know, we don't know how effective and successful these candidates are going to be. You know, obviously they're going to have pretty varying levels of success. But, you know, it would be good if the media or the political journalists actually learnt from this election that this isn't just, you know, a single movement, a single party, a single entity. It's not a monolith. It's something that's actually emerged from the profound frustrations that a lot of voters feel about politics as business as usual. And, of course, you know, one of the biggest upholders of politics as business as usual is the media.
Which does raise the question, I suppose, is there an element that this could end up being a strange sort of simulacra of what happened in 2019, where no one could possibly see the coalition winning? Is there a sense that maybe we're a little bit out of touch now in the press gallery in terms of the possibility of a real sweep of these independent candidates?
Oh, look, we're not going to be able to answer that until election night, maybe in a couple of weeks afterwards. Yeah, look, I've seen a lot of polls floating around. Well, not a lot, but I've seen, you know, several polls floating around about individual seats. They're usually run by an interested party. So I tend to take those sort of polls with a grain of salt. But what is clear is that there is significant discontent. There are a lot of voters who, in seats like the one I live in, North Sydney, and elsewhere on the North Shore, you know, that they have seen what happened in 2019 with Zali Steggall. There is a concerted effort to see if something like that can be replicated, or simply to change politics. I mean, one of the things that the voices of North Sydney, which doesn't endorse Kylie Tink, one of the things they've been doing is they've been trying to keep up the pressure on Trent Zimmerman for him to make commitments about, you know, what he's going to do if he wins. This is about, you know, there are different strategies and tactics here being employed. It's not necessarily about knocking off a Liberal moderate. It may in some cases be, how can we get this Liberal moderate to actually deliver more for us, deliver more of what we actually want? You know, and that's just one example of, you know, how wide-ranging what's going on actually is, and how, you know, we're all going to look at election night results and say, well, was this a success or not? But maybe the answer is really a longer-term one of, does this terrify so-called Liberal moderates into actually living up to their their self-titled description a bit more effectively in the next parliament?
Fascinating stuff. Well, Bernard, thank you so much for joining us. That's probably all the time we have now. I'm sorry for everyone who tuned in that we did got off a little bit too late. But thank you so much, Bernard, for joining us. Bernard, for anyone who's just tuned in, is our politics editor here at Crikey. We'll be back tomorrow at the same time. But please do keep an eye out for our afternoon edition of Crikey Daily, which we go out twice a day during the election. And if you'd like to catch up on our previous podcasts, you can find Crikey's Election Cast on most podcast platforms. Thank you so much for joining us, everyone.
Charlie Lewis, Crikey's Tips and Moments editor, talking to political editor Bernard Keane there. That is Crikey's Election Cast for today. We will be back tomorrow afternoon in your ears. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast and review it if you like what we're doing. And you can find everything that the two discussed here and more on crikey.com.au. Bye.